this moment, we are a consciousness, this is the experience of consciousness. So that there's this awareness of things, conscious formation. So the things that come into consciousness, such as my voice now is in your consciousness. Or when you're looking at me, then my form is in your consciousness. It's consciousness. There's the body, there's consciousness. This is a sensory realm, so we feel like we feel attraction, repulsion, pleasure, pain, heat and cold to the senses, to the mind. There's the posture, the role sitting and breathing, and there's the sound of silence. So this is calling everyone. We're not talking about individual personality. So what I'm doing is establishing a mindful reflection on the way it is before we get into the personal issues. Because even though we're conscious, we aren't aware of it. Usually we look up the word vijnana in a Pali dictionary, trying to find out how to define consciousness, when the actual experience is right now. So the body is as it is. It's a function, it's a condition in nature. It follows the laws of nature. It gets born, grows up, gets old and dies. It's subject to all the impressions of a lifetime that impinge on it. Humans have a retentive memory, so we remember. We have language, and therefore we have memory, so we can remember things that happened to us many years ago, yesterday, which affect us now. Like I can remember something, some miserable incident that happened to you in your past. And then it's still miserable, isn't it? The memory is still miserable. And if you hold the memory, you feel miserable with it. Because the memories are static things, aren't they? You can remember some unpleasant incident in school when you were 7 years old, or something like this. And even when you're 70, you can still feel miserable when you remember it. It is pointing to that. That's just, to understand why we experience suffering. Consciousness is a function in it, it's not personal. That's been quite an impact. And I just realized consciousness was just a very functional thing. Not like my consciousness. We're all conscious in the same way. Nothing is a function. The conditions that might be in consciousness are infinitely variable. So what you remember, the bad incident you remember, if we're all remembering bad incidents in our past, then the commonality we're remembering, but the actual incident itself is unique. There is one of them. So that's where the personality develops, isn't it? Around the sense of uniqueness. My soul, I was brought up to think that I have a unique soul that will, and when I die, if I'm a good Christian, my soul will go, and I'll be, I wasn't Ajahn Sumedho then. I will be Robert for eternity. Now we have a unique soul that will live with God forever. So I'll always be me in this unique way. This is how I was taught in my Christian background. The sense of being, I am a totally unique person. And then that also implies as a soul I'm unique. The idea of losing that uniqueness, that specialness, that's just me and not you, is encouraged. Emphasized over and over again. And so the idea of just being like somebody else was horrible. I don't want to be like anyone else, I want to be unique. I could see you. But then on reflection, being a unique person is a experience of loneliness. You know, being special, being unique, being an individual, being a separate personality, as its good side, it's not all bad, but in the long run, you end up feeling alienated and lonely. And so there's a longing for union in there, for oneness, in all of this kind of, either by merging with some other person, hopefully like the romantic ideal, is to merge, become one with some other person, or with God, or with nature, in a mystical union with nature, or in terms of Dhamma, we're letting go of the illusion of separateness. So in Buddhism, we're investigating the way things are until we see we're letting go of the illusory separateness which we create out of these perceptions. Then the loneliness goes. The personality stops away. All the special qualities are no longer important. So in establishing mindfulness with the body, with the breath, with the sound of silence, reflecting on things in terms of Dhamma, then the Dhamma is common to us all, it's not Krishna. It's Dhamma rather than my special quality. And then by having that foundation, then we can begin to reflect or mirror all the personal qualities that we are strongly identified or strongly attached to, and that create, and which we create suffering. I went to the funeral last week in California.
Yes.
Master Chuan Hua died last June, and he was 77 years old. Was a highly regarded Chinese monk, has established many monasteries, in, especially in North America. Had a huge following, especially Chinese. There was a huge Chinese community in California now. And I met him about 1981, and felt great affinities with this monk, and developed friendship with him and his community in California. So they invited me to the funeral. Master Hua, his teachings were always, you know, I come out of nothing and go back to nothing. And this was something that before he died, he didn't want any kind of like big monuments made for him or anything. Just scatter the ashes in the air. Like going back to nothing. So anyway, I had a chance to contemplate his corpse. They had it on display in one of their buildings. And I was just watching. You could just see his face, and the rest of him was covered. He was in a refrigerated coffin. A nice coffin valve in refrigeration. And just watching the face of his teacher that I had known alive, and then it was a good reflection on just seeing the body with no personality in it. I create a personality onto it. I can do that. He's like this. I can, you know, and I'm looking at his face, and then I think, that's Master Chuan Hua. He's like this, he said that, he's done this. That's me. You know, that's my mind creating something onto that form. Then when they cremated him, there were thousands of people there, and there was just strong emotion. Chinese people mainly were just, you know, weeping and tremendous grief at the loss of this teacher, who was greatly loved and revered. And I've contemplated grief a lot over the past few years, because I've lost parents, teacher, Ajahn Chah, Master Hua, friends and other people that were very close to me have died, or have been separated from. So this grief is the experience of loss, isn't it? How I use the word grief. Loss of the love. So then I noticed that this grief to bring it on, you have to remember, you have to think. So then I start thinking about Master Hua, and I start crying. I feel his grief, a sense of loss as a person. On the personal level, I feel the loss. Then I go into the silence of my mind. And would not think anymore. And then there'd be no grief. Now this is experimenting with these things. And when in that silence, where you're not creating, you're not thinking, not getting caught up in your thoughts and memories, what happened was a feeling of joyfulness. Because I could see that all it does is really just a body. That what he taught was not dead. What he was pointing to was always with us. You know, he's pointing to the Dhamma. He wasn't pointing to himself as a person. I mean, if he was just pointing to himself as a person, then that's the end of it. He's gone, there's nothing left. But because his teaching was about Dhamma, the way things are, then you realize he was merely like a vehicle for that, a kind of channel or condition, a condition that was pointing toward the Dhamma, the finger pointing at the moon. He wasn't in himself. I mean, we create him into a person, just like we create ourselves into the personality. So there's an interesting combination of just watching the personal grief and then being able to experience the joy of the Dhamma. They're not like any great distance from each other. But it's in understanding how your mind is, how your mind is. That's why I emphasize this silence. And it's this attention, this openness, this receptive attentiveness, where you begin to realize the experience of emptiness and non-self. Because you're not shutting down, you're not closing off, you're not repressing, but you're not falling, you're not creating anything either. It's just this simple paying attention, listening, awakened awareness. When my mother died, that was about 7 years ago, and they were Roman Catholics, so I had to go to this Catholic funeral in San Diego. And and of course in the monastic life, you get these stories, like if you're really mindful, you wouldn't feel any grief. So, I mean, because you hear things like this, and then if you're mindful, you don't feel any grief. And so I remember before feeling even guilty about grieving, because I think I'm not being mindful, I should be. So, I mean, the ego is there, isn't it? You know, I'm a bhikkhu, I'm a Buddhist monk, meditation teacher, all that, and I've got to set an example, got to be this kind of figure of, you know, who isn't grieving over anything, because I'm always mindful. So by the time my mother and father died, they died, and they were very old. Like my father was 91 and my mother 88. And it certainly wasn't like a surprise. My sister and I were both, you know, we realized it could happen. I mean, the past 2 decades, we were quite ready for it, you know, on the level of knowing it could happen at any time. But when it happened, I noticed when you first hear it, it's like your mother's dead. Even though you intellectually prepared yourself for years for that moment, emotionally, it's different. It's not all the intellectual preparation. That's good to do. But also, when the actual experience happens, then it's a you're feeling it. It's an experience of feeling rather than an abstract idea. So the concept of death, and as a mother is dead, is a different experience than, well, she's 88, she's going to die in time. And so death always means, it means loss for us, doesn't it? We don't know what it is. We've not died. We don't know how to relate to it, usually. It just means they're no longer with us. And you don't know where they are, what happened. If they were sick in a hospital or something, we could relate to any form of pain or thing dealing with life. But death shuts the mind off. What happened? Blank. Don't know. And then so I determined not to just watch what happened during the funeral, my mother's funeral. Not try to control my mind in terms of repress my feelings or repress any grief that I might be feeling. Or what the tendency to do that, like for men to be caught in public weeping is sometimes embarrassing, at least from the way I was brought up. We're not supposed to be crying. So you still have this kind of conditioning, feeling of embarrassment about showing emotion. But just observing it, watching during the funeral was a Christian one, and it never reflected on what actually happened. It was all about God and what a wonderful person my mother was, and now she's happy in heaven with the Lord and all that. Which is kind of nice, it's a beautiful perception that can comfort your mind. But you're not really watching what's really happening. You're merely kind of being padded, and don't worry, everything's fine. Don't cry, it's all right. She's happy now with the Lord. I want my mother to be happy. And she wanted to go and live with the Lord, so I'm sure she's happier there than she was with my father. I'd rather live with the Lord than my father. But in reflective awareness, this is what I'm wondering, you're not trying to control yourself in terms of if I really shouldn't feel these things, if I'm really mindful I won't be crying or anything. We're not coming from a position of what we should be feeling, but we're noticing what's actually taking place within us. That's why with reflective meditation you're actually observing. You're not judging. You're not putting any kind of judgment, value judgment on it, or analyzing it. You're not analyzing yourself, but just noticing. Right now, the feeling is like this. And of course, feeling or mood is you can't really define it. How do you define it? You say grief, but grief isn't it's just a word. It doesn't, you know, you've got to, the experience of grief is not the word itself. So you begin, so the word sometimes helps you to maybe get in touch with what you're feeling. You say, like when somebody dies, we experience grief. Doesn't mean that we should be experiencing grief, but it's pointing to the experience of loss of love. And what does it feel like? What is it as an experience? And so the love, say, is what we want, what we like to be with, what gives us, which, you know, on the personal level, to have loved ones, to have warm relationships, to have friends, to have teachers that you respect, to have a God that you love, to love England or Britain, or to love your mother, grandmother, father, so forth. Love your wife, husband, children, cat. And what's been feeling incredible grief over loss of a cat? A goldfish? Or a plant? My sister one time came in bereft, crying, weeping, tears pouring down her face because one of her favorite roses had died. The experience of loss of the love. I mean, we might think, well, that's silly, but I'm not pointing as a value judgment that it's good or bad, but it's like this. It feels and it is like this. And so by reflecting this way, we begin to embrace that feeling. We can by totally accepting what we're feeling, we can endure that feeling. We can bear with grief. Grief is a feeling we can bear if we accept it for what it is. And then it's impermanent, so it goes. It ceases, and then non-grief. Then you begin to recognize non-grief. Grief takes you to non-grief. But what happens with the many of us is that we never really understand what's happening. So loss of a loved one, we feel grief, but we don't understand it. Then if we hear, if your mind, but you wouldn't be crying, or you wouldn't, and then you know, I've been practicing Buddhist meditation, but when my mother dies, it's of no use to me. Doesn't do me any good, because I feel suffering when my mother died. I shouldn't, if I'd been really practicing, I wouldn't be suffering like this. And that's because you're grasping an idea of Buddhism. You're not practicing Dhamma. You're getting the ideas, but you're not, and you're holding on to ideas, but you're not experiencing the Dhamma, realizing the Dhamma. Because the Dhamma is like this. It's not that you don't cry anymore. So you don't feel it. You feel, you're willing to feel. You have the space, the freedom, the encouragement to feel life, to be with what you're feeling. In which you can resolve those feelings. Those feelings, then you can let them go. Well, you can't let go of things if you're just reacting out of ignorance and habit. Even if you suppress your feelings, eventually they'll you know, you have a nervous breakdown or something will come and force you to have some contact, confronted in some way or another. So in Buddhist meditation, we're learning to flow with life, to take things as we're experiencing, so that the loss of the love is being fully understood when it's happening, rather than ignoring it, pushing it away, and then 20 years from now, suddenly realizing you're terribly depressed because you've never dealt with the loss of loved ones when it happened 20 years before. That's what happens to a lot of people. They suddenly find they're terribly depressed at the age of 50 because when they were 15, their mother died. And they made no connection. There's been no resolution of that. It's merely suddenly at a much older age, you can't just run around and distract yourself and you kind of done all the things to kind of entertain, excite, stimulate your mind, and then nothing works anymore. And then suddenly you're faced with unresolved emotions, emotional blockages. So this is why in meditation, we're not just trying to get into a nice tranquil place where you're just sitting there and you don't feel anything but bliss. That's what many of us started with the hope. I hope to avoid all of it. When I first started meditating, I didn't want to be hurt by life. I didn't want to experience the unpleasantness of life. So I thought, I'll become a monk, and I'll learn to get into those nice, high, tranquil states. And the world can do whatever it's doing. And it's not going to affect me. It's like being born in John all the time. Totally blissed out. And that was why, because there was a lot of fear, about life living, about not knowing myself, not knowing how to deal with emotional experiences, not understanding them. But then the only thing I could think of was trying to avoid everything as much as possible, anything that might bring unpleasant emotions into my consciousness. There's a whole pattern of avoiding situations or denial that one has developed. Then in the monastic life, that's not what happens. Because you're living closely with people and you're irritating each other enormously when you live with each other. And eventually, you lose loved ones. You develop the enormous respect and love for Ajahn Chah, because he had his stroke. That was why, I felt more grief when he had his stroke than when he actually died. And I know many Western monks, many Westerners go into monasteries in order to avoid things and to try to attain a high state of tranquility, bliss. But in the long run, you inevitably have to deal with life, with the human side of our experience. And this you can't get away from in a monastery either. So the thing is, when you begin to appreciate the Buddhist teaching, like of vipassana or the satipatthana, then you begin to realize what the Buddha was pointing to was a real profound investigation of life. of the mind, of the emotions, of the intellect, of the instinctual drives, of everything. There's nothing that we're forbidden to look at and to investigate. And these words like investigation, examination, looking into, they have this Pali word yoniso manasikara, very important word in Pali, means to get to the very heart of the matter, to the original cause, to go right to the cause. Now as you begin to recognize your, feel at ease with feeling like, rather than feel embarrassed by it, or feeling that you shouldn't, you know, that you shouldn't be feeling, like the Sandy Burnfield last night was saying, to feel it's all right to be depressed, it's okay to be depressed. I mean, that's quite an insight for most people, because we usually, when we feel depressed, we feel we shouldn't be. And so then we go and take antidepressants to go, you know, try to get rid of it in some way. Because we think it's like, you know, we're abnormal for feeling what we're feeling. If I were a normal person, I wouldn't feel this. And people think like this. Don't be depressed, you know. You shouldn't be depressed. Life is wonderful. And God, I hate people like that. When you're depressed, you don't. That doesn't do any good. To be, have some kind of silly cheering up. Because sometimes life is depressing. And this is where we reflect on it. Like right now, say, for me, this experience here at this time, this sunny weather. Went out after the morning meditation, sat in the flower garden, and it's like being in paradise. There's nothing to be depressed about this morning. There's no kind of things coming on me that were negative and unpleasant. So in sitting in the sun, in the flower garden, waiting to go to breakfast, you know, it's kind of easy, pleasant life we're living here at Leicester. nothing depressing, nothing in it that brings up negativity in my mind. But there could be, like, what if it suddenly turned cold and started raining? What if then everybody started complaining? And what if suddenly you read too many of these newspapers and you get depressed? And you read about all those Bosnian Muslims that a couple of weeks ago that were just dumped in a field and all the men killed. And that's depressing. I mean, just hearing that is depressing. I mean, it brings in a negative feeling in the mind. It feels like this, doesn't it? When you hear that all these people, and we can identify with all these women and children and old men, and all the young ones taken out and murdered. I mean, that's pretty close. I mean, they're like us. And they show pictures of Bosnian people. They look just like English people. They aren't like Martians. Really. So, I mean, the more you begin to see, you know, you hear this little girl that was murdered, Sophie, or these two boys, this kind of news, this kind of perception, what does it do to your mind? And it is, if that's what you fill your mind with a lot, then you feel you feel a move toward the depression, negativity, despair. Because they're actually feeding on negative perception, filling the mind with negativity. And so if you don't understand what's happening, and all you hear is bad news, complaint, bad weather, bad food, noise, unpleasant noises, sound, loud rocket sound, jets flying overhead, you find out you have a terminal illness, you have a bad back with a lot of pain, you've got asthma, and you've got all these allergies, plus you've got the latest the flu epidemic, and then you're depressed. It's a very natural way to So I mean, this is just a reflection on that life. Sometimes it has its peaks, its good times, in this realm that we're living in. It can be very pleasant, very beautiful, but it also can be hellish. But this which is aware, this is your refuge, this awareness of. It's like this is like a barometer or something. Like this form, this conscious experience. You don't want to be. You don't have to go up and down with the temperature or the weather. Just be high when it's sunny and low when it's cold and wet. But you're finding this place, this stillness within you that is your refuge, where. What happens to you then is in a perspective of Dhamma. What arises ceases. You're continuously reflecting on the changingness and the flux of the conditioned realm, because you're transcending it. You're not. I'm no longer identified in the conditioning of the body or the condition of the mind. That's the gate to immortality. Mindfulness is the gate to immortality. It's through that attentive awareness that we realize the deathness, where then we can bear with the changing conditions and experiences of our human state. Just watch yourself, just listen to yourself sometimes when you're in, to see how hard we can be on ourselves. We're always, I notice in so many people, including myself, it tends to be very judgmental. Yeah, I shouldn't be feeling like this. I shouldn't think like this, or I shouldn't be like this. I mean, that kind of inner tyrant that continuously kind of destroys you. Even when you do something really good, it'll say something nasty to you. But it is it's just a dead habit. It's a habit you've acquired. It's not like there's any real tyrant inside you, or there's any kind of external source that is influencing you. It is a habit that you've acquired. It's an acquired habit. And so it's something you can also relinquish. It's not something that you... that is yours and will be with you forever. Now this willingness to accept what you're feeling, I found that quite difficult, because I'm a person that likes to sing. And I know, especially men, I think women, generally speaking, are more aware of what they're feeling. I notice with men, sometimes we're not aware at all of what they're feeling. So, some of them are. I think almost all the nuns, you know, I think they're aware of what they're feeling. But they, and I think this is a problem that men have, is learning how to feel life. And then with women, how to interpret feeling. So that it's not so, they're not creating so much suffering by their sensitivity. Because women suffer a lot because of that. They're so aware of what they're feeling. And they don't know how to interpret, how to relate to it. It's merely just being overwhelmed by feeling. And with gender, exactly. With men, we really need to investigate feeling. Be willing to feel. And how to interpret feeling, that is seen in terms of Dhamma. Whatever is subject to arising, subject to ceasing. It's not a put down, it's not to say, oh well, I'm depressed now, but it's just impermanent and dismiss it as impermanent. That's not it. The teachings of Anicca Dukkha Anatta are there to investigate and to remind you that even though you might feel that right now, because you lost your loved one, that you'll never have a happy moment in your life again, you're so grief-stricken that you can't imagine ever being happy ever again in your life, that also is a burden. I mean, depression, when you're depressed, you can't imagine ever being happy. It's impossible. As soon as you start imagining, if you start having hope, oh, I'll be happy someday, you won't be depressed anymore. It's as simple as that. Depression and kind of where it's really strong is where you believe it totally, and there's no hope left. I've ruined my life. I'm a failure. Life is horrible. I'll never be happy again. And we believe it completely. So that's why the refuge is a sati, mindfulness, awareness, panya, wisdom, seeing things as they are, with the feeling, with emotion, to be able to accept your emotion. We also have to learn how to accept emotions we don't like. I noticed one time a woman came to me and she was very upset by something. She's a very intelligent person, a very well-educated woman. And she said, I'm being silly, I know. And she's crying. Here I am crying again. And what a silly fool I am. Because intellectually she was judging her emotional state. Because intellectually she was saying, oh, this is stupid, here I'm a weeping woman making a fool of myself in front of this mug. You know, I hate it. I hate this geeky stuff that women do. And then, but emotionally, she was feeling something that she couldn't control anymore, just to kind of make it, shut it out with her will. There's a conflict, wasn't there, between her emotions and her intellect. Intellectually, she hated her emotions. But her emotion was strong where she couldn't control it anymore. So, this is, and her emotion, I forget what was bothering her, but it wasn't like anything all that, like stretched long or something, but I think it was like the last straw. Something insignificant happened in which she just suddenly exploded in it. It was the last straw. So in itself, what it brought up the emotion seemed trivial. If you were thinking about it in terms of the intellectual judging. But in meditation also, you'll find all kinds of things coming up in the consciousness. And these emotions, many of them we don't like at all, but they're okay. If they come up, if they come, they go. Remember that. Whatever comes, goes. So it's not that. It's anatta. Nothing to make a problem about. It is what it is. It feels like this. You're not trying to say something it isn't. You're not judging it by saying I shouldn't be thinking or feeling in this way. You're willing to be with it, to bear with that experience. And so this receptiveness in meditation, like embracing that kind of wide, universal taking on, rather than focusing on one thing and shutting everything out. The difference between samatha and vipassana. Samatha meditation where you focus on a refined object to get refined, to get a high level to get a refined conscious experience. Vipassana is opening the gate wide, total receptivity, where you can investigate what happened, the things you're experiencing, but has done that, rather than a personal problem. That's how we tend to do. I have so many personal problems. Where when you see things in the right way, then the problems, they seem personal. But they're seen as an object in the mind, rather than from the personal perspective of where we tend to judge them. Because we have ideas about what I like to be as a person, what I like to appear like as a person. I like to appear in public, dignified. And I want to look dignified. I don't want to look foolish inside of me. I want to appear in a way that I can be respected and not look down on. I want to be appreciated. I want to be liked. I want to be accepted. I want to, I don't want to have to deal with difficult or embarrassing situations. I want all of you to be polite and say nice things and not bring up any embarrassing subjects or push me up against the wall into the corner. Let's have a account. It's a very nice time, like children dancing around in a circle. So and but then sometimes life puts us in humiliating positions. Falling down the stairs. So that brings up the sense of oneself too, that the accidents or the, like spilling a cup of coffee on your lap or saying something thing in public or just whatever things happen, we can feel very embarrassed and even suicidal about. But in a tradition of the knowing, when everything is accepted in this way, it's not that we have to kind of let everything hang loose, kind of. It's not into going to the other extreme of just saying exactly what we're thinking and feeling and following every impulse, because that would be pretty horrible too. Would be horrible, listening politely to each other. They on the level of society, we have rules and ways of relating to each other which they show respect and sensitivity and etiquette, good manners. All these are helpful in social settings and in communities and in families. But also we need to really know what we're feeling and not just expect life to be polite and pleasant for us, but to be able to use even the complications and humiliations and embarrassment, the whole lot, as Dhamma, seeing it as Dhamma rather than as personal success or failure. So this what I sense this morning is that I think it would like to be shut. Okay. What have we been talking about anyway? Well, say the personal perception of yourself is that this is how I would describe it. I don't know if you. But anyway, we start usually from I am this person. There's something wrong with me. I've got to do something in order to become enlightened sometime in the future. So I'm sure all of us start out with that. I started meditation because I could see I had all kinds of failings, inadequacies as a person. I was unhappy. I wanted to do something about it in order to become what I thought would be an enlightened person in the future. Or become a normal person, or become a happy person, whatever. But then, and that will oftentimes bring us to meditation or to Buddhism, this idea of, I'm confused, I've got a lot of problems, I need help, I need to do something in order to become something in the future. So notice that way of thinking is from the condition of your mind. That's how we're culturally conditioned to think. When I think of myself as a person, I tend to see the fault more easily than the virtue. I'm more aware of my faults and my weaknesses than I am of my virtues as a person as my personality. Then because one is oftentimes so aware of one's faults and weaknesses that when we meditate, we operate in the idea that I couldn't have these faults and weaknesses, so I've got to get rid of them by doing something. So we know it's meditation technique, or we have these
faults and weaknesses that we have, that I shouldn't have. But if you don't get behind the basic delusion of self, then at the end of many years of trying to get rid of your weaknesses, you feel like you're a failure. Because you haven't broken through the basic illusion of self yet. You still, you're meditating with the assumption, I am the body, I am this person, I am these faults are me. And so, this is where in your refuge of Buddha Dhamma Sangha, it's like listening to what you think you are. That is listening to your own views of what you think you are. It's not that. That is listening and knowing. Is that greed? Is it hatred? You might feel greedy. You might feel bad.
Hatred. You might feel
jealousy or fear or all kinds of emotions. They
might be feeding on.
The fact that you're aware of them. Ask yourself, is that self-fire, or is that greed, or is that hatred? And suddenly you find in the world that security. Look at awaken the weird. That, and then enlightenment isn't something you attain, it's something which is your natural way of being. And you're letting go of that, you're seeing things in the right way. Where on the personal level, we talk in terms of who became enlightenment, and that's just a worldly conventional way of thinking. But that's not actually how it is. That's not
in terms of Dhamma,
that's not what actually
happens.
So you have these
kind of matter, these
kind of paradoxes
in Buddhism.
There is the path, but no one is on the path. And they say, oh, nobody's get on the path. That's good. That. But there is the path, but to
realize the path, you have to let go of being
part
of it. To be what you think you are. And like that purity. It's the same for you, it's the same purity, it's not personal. That pure awareness is where we want, we're not still. It's not personal, it's not a matter of culture, it's not male or female. It's transcending all of that. Just that attention now. Like listening. I like this image of a Native American, Red Indian, listening, out in nature, listening to the deer walking in the forest. You know, with that perfect attention of her, receptive attention. He doesn't have an agenda going on in his head. Well, I gotta go out and shoot deer today. the other phrase, he shot a bigger deer than I did last year. I'm gonna do it. When we're talking personality, right? When we're like in nature, like here in the garden. If you're thinking about everything, you're not aware of the beauty around you. You can walk out there through this whole botanical garden and be thinking about everything but not noticing anything. But when you walk out, if your mind's empty, then you're receptive, you're with that. And things begin to teach you. You know, you're aware of things, of what's happening, what's with you, rather than operating from preconditioning. So enlightenment is, it's to see things in the right way. And it's not personal. So I can't say anyone's attained enlightenment, even though we talk like that, in actual, the way it is that nobody attains it. As we learn to relinquish, then that's our natural way of being. That's natural to us. And so even like somebody with MS, or cancer, or AIDS, or anything, these are not problems for enlightenment. These aren't obstructions. Because you can, because this is just what happens to the body, and it's like in the talk last night. You suffer if you resent it. If you just accept it, and even though it is painful or unpleasant in itself, you're not resisting it, you're not hating it. So then all you have is the MS, you don't have the mental misery. So sometimes you meet people who have very painful illnesses who are quite joyful.
They shouldn't be so happy. They've got chronic pain, terrible physical problems. Why are they so happy? But if they're not creating suffering, you know, the pain is there. It's not still painful, but it's not. But there's a difference between physical pain and the dukkha, or the suffering we create in the first year, not wanting it. And so this is the way out, is to recognize, to realize the way things are. This realm we live in is like this. It's a pain realm. A lot of pain in this realm that you're probably all aware of. It's natural in this realm. It's a sensitive realm.
Where does compassion fit? I'm thinking in particular of children, and look at happening all the time. The world, if sometimes one looks, attempts to look at it and sees this is how it is, there's still a desire to, maybe it's just a desire, to feel that There must be something that can be not perhaps physical, but in compassion, if it not necessarily wrong, because that's a nice word again to use, but to have metta compassion for things as they are, or even just being as it is.
To me, that the Brahma Vihara, the Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upekkha, they're like that's a way of relating to life from the purity of the mind. They're called the pure abode, they have this, because they're natural responses to suffering, like Karuna or compassion is a natural response to the suffering of others. It's not like a contrived thing that you're trying to feel sorry for somebody. It's like you understand suffering, and you're willing to suffer with people. You're willing to accept their suffering. When we hear about like a bald man. Because of that goodness, that we can feel this compassion for the suffering of those people, but also we have to extend compassion to both try. Like I remember when they were having the ethnic cleansing last year, we kind of did the raping of the Muslim women, and all this atrocity. And then the kind of righteous, indignant side of me was very, you could see, I felt a lot of compassion for the victim, but anger towards the victimizer. You know, like wanting to have them punished. And then on further reflection, I began to think the ones that really need the compassion are the victimizers. They're the ones that really are important. It's better to be beaten than to beat somebody. I mean, I'd rather be beaten up than beat up somebody, knowing what I know now. I wouldn't want to be responsible for beating up somebody. But if somebody beats me up, I hope I can be compassionate toward them. Because the ones who are actually performing these atrocities and that, like, their karma is so bad. What they've done is so horrible that it's much worse than the victim if they abuse. And so when we contemplate like that, then you feel this compassion for all beings, because people do these things out of ignorance. They don't know. They don't know what they're doing. They're just caught in the fear. I mean, we don't know what it'd be like to be a young man, 18-year-old, thrown into a battlefield. You might have been a good boy before, but when your life is in danger and you see all kinds of horrors going on, something goes, you know, here, like from Vietnam vet, you know, something, you know, they might have been pretty nice people before, but when they're thrown into a state of violence and fear and survival, and other things take over. And this is where, like, forgiveness, compassion for all is universal compassion, rather than just sympathy for the victims of life. Thich Nhat Hanh, he has a poem about that. I am the kill, I am the killer.
It's quite difficult to explain.
Tell me, Jasper, about the grief, the book is just anger and grief. I don't know whether that's wrong, but sometimes when a big grief comes on, when you can't, sometimes you do shut down because it's too much. Is it possible maybe by attending more to our little griefs, by putting that much more attention to them, that we can, as it were, kind of loosen up? I don't know. So that when the big ones come along, we're that much more flexible, open to kind of handle them, or doesn't it work like that?
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. Because grief happens to us a lot, whether you know it, whether you know it as grief, a sense of loss. And that's why, like, you're contemplating it. I mean, your mother dies, that's a big grief, or something really, like Ajahn Chah, somebody that's very important. But in an ordinary life, say, before those things happen, there's a lot of grief, a loss of things. Loss of friendship, for changing, things changing for the worse. The things of loss of your youth, or loss of something, of whatever. Unlike when you, if you have to move, sometimes you experience grief. You know, you've lived in a house for a long time, then you have to move to another one. And then you find yourself with a sense of grief. You know, you don't know what it is. You think, I should be able to just do that, you know, up here in your head. You know, oh, I'm just being a silly fool. And one house is as good as another. I mean, that's intellectual, you know, that's... But in terms of what you're feeling.
It's also, I think, the loss, the person who lost and you lose them, not only the loss, but the their loss. All that you had wished for them, when you finish it.
Yeah.
And my friend, a friend of mine years ago, illustrated that other world, and she said, did you know that I'm dead and her family? And I said, oh, how plain. And then she was on holiday somewhere abroad, and she came back and claimed her. But anyway, it's nice to know she'd had her holiday.
Because we do tend to see it only in terms of a big grief. It actually is quite a common emotion. You call me human experience. Something seems is easier for me to acknowledge than joy. It's funny, I mean, it's strange, because everyone thinks you want happiness and joy, but that's a very good question. Because like mudita, or the third Brahma Vihara, mudita is joy. And I was contemplating that because I found, usually it's described as joy at the beauty of others or the success of others. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it's the antidote to jealousy, where you, and envy, where you feel, you know, somebody's better off than you, and you feel jealous of them rather than happy for them. And then I began to think of mudita also as a kind of the joy of, like when you look at flowers, or where you appreciate the beauty of something as a form of mudita, and where you can really appreciate the beauty or the goodness of someone else. It's easier to appreciate flowers, but sometimes with other people, we're so competitive or comparing ourselves with them that we lack this joy. We can't really love someone else's beauty or wisdom if we're thinking that it's better than ours. I think so that kind of personal element destroys it. But when you let go of that, break through the personal conditioning, then that's also natural. Feeling of real joy at the beauty of others, the goodness of others, the wisdom of others, the beauty of things. Like sometimes in Buddhism we think, oh, you know, beauty is impermanent and it's dukkha. So you look at the flowers here, they're all dukkha too. You know, you shouldn't attach to beauty. And this is a kind of aberration in Buddhism, where because the noble truth is on suffering, but it's not to project suffering on the thing, but to notice. It's just a skillful means to look at suffering in order to free yourself from it. When the mind is no longer creating suffering, then the natural response to beauty is joy. Delight in the beauty of others. Not trying to get it for yourself. You know, you're not trying to, and you see, you know, the possessive mind, you see something you want it for yourself. And that destroys, you can't enjoy something that way. I mean, you can't really be with it. You merely see it and you want it. You're following an impulse. A greedy impulse. But if you see through that, then life continuously filled with a joyfulness, because there is a lot of beauty around us, beauty in us. Can you appreciate your own beauty? And then the critical mind, the selfish mind, like, well, you know, I don't have any great beautiful things. But that's not true. I mean, I think just what brings us to a Buddhist summer school, where we, you know, you might, oh, I just want to have a holiday and see my friends. Put your motives down to very selfish motive, but and that's what we tend to do. We tend to pick up on sometimes the lowest one and say that this is the honest truth. I'm doing it because I'm selfish. But I don't believe that anymore. I think, you know, even though we might be meditating, coming to summer school, going on retreat, there might be a selfish. There might be selfishness included in it. I say the real reason is because of our love of beauty and truth. And I'm trying to influence you more to think like that than to think that you're coming to a meditation retreat or to a summer school just because of, for some kind of obsessive, selfish reason. I mean, not to deny there might be selfish reasons involved, but that's not the important one.
It may just be a semantic difference, but I think that there's a three-way paradox in coming to yourself. Because obviously, if you're grieving, then you're not feeling particularly happy, but you can still feel good. Because I think happiness is explanatory, and it depends upon whether it's the same way around you, but you're in any kind of play. So you can breathe with your own happiness, which is a little bit. It's the deep well of joy and pride that you can go into the good and come out the other end, hope you're staying good, and go on the same thing to the other side, and that's the difference. Where I think if you rely on external happiness, I've got a new job, I've got a new car, whatever that appears, that you do unhappy, which is something more than that.
Yeah.
And it's that that keeps you going through the whole thing. I find that.
Yes, I agree. And that's how I would define it. Happiness, I use the word happiness more or less as external things, that like you get something you want, or your success, or and things make you happy when you get them. But it doesn't last very long. And then to be happy, you always have to be getting things, having reinforcement, positive reinforcement for everything. But then, and joy is a deeper experience where it's coming from inside you. It's how you relate to life, even to grief. It's how you relate even to the loss of the love, which isn't happy, but but you're right. You can be joyful even when you're grieving, because. Like with Master Hua, this was quite interesting to see. I was experiencing both grief and joy.
I feel that I feel very, very happy and go to the mirror to comb my hair, get a horrendous shock with this thing that's in the mirror, then find it frightfully funny and feel joy. So I go through three emotions in a matter of seconds.
I sometimes think it's not a matter of wanting it. I know some of it called things that happen, done it, gifts. And often life gives you bonuses that you're not looking for when you are miserable, and they're given to you, you don't have to look for them. It just happens. The flower or something, or someone smiling, it's all, it can suddenly really great, like, magic thing. And that's just, it's part of the thing.
I was, 93, Ajahn Sajito and I went for a walk in the Pyrenees for 2 weeks, and we were mixed up. One of those two dogs backpacked. We flew to Lourdes, and then we walked from Lourdes up to the Spanish border, and then crossed over, and we had this really good time camping and walking in France and Spain on the Pyrenees. And the last day, we crossed back into France over a path, and it was raining. And it was the last day of this hike, and then we were go to a certain place and camp, and then the next day somebody was going to come and get us in a car. But that day we crossed over the pass. Nick decided he wanted to go on a shortcut, so we had to cross, go down this grassy slope, and the grass was wet, and I fell and strained my leg, this leg, which isn't very good anyway. And so then we were way out, far away from everything, and it was raining cats and dogs. And then I had this incredibly painful leg. I had to walk on for several miles more. And this rain was unrelenting, and this pain was unrelenting. And then I had and then finally I couldn't walk anymore. It was too painful, so we put up a tent And you're on this steep slope, so there's no flat area. So then they put up my little tent, and where your my bottom would touch the ground was this stump sticking up your leg. So then even in the even trying to lie down in this tent, this stump had a up like this, and it was cold, and everything was wet, and hungry, and the rain kept going, and it seemed relentless, and it seemed like, and I kept using the situation, but it did seem like everything was miserable that day, absolutely everything. There was unrelenting misery. And then the next day, I was in the pain, really, it was a very painful pain. And I had to get out of this tent, and the sun was shining. So that brought in some positive feeling. And then Nick had managed to, in that night, go down, find a telephone, and phone his friend. So she came in a car that morning. And when I heard the car coming, I felt this incredible joy. And then this woman got out of the car with a pair of crutches, and I felt more joyful. And then here I was